Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to start with a study out of New Zealand Institute for Plant and Food Research and Northumbria University. And it's all about black currants. Well, we know the black currants are very rich in phytonutrients, polyphenols, but the research has shown that black currants, and you can get them year-round dried, are good for keeping us mentally young and agile. And finding this is important because think how many people could just have a quarter of a cup of black currants each day, throw it in your smoothie, throw it in a hot cereal. But this can help people with brain disorders like Parkinson's disease or even depression. Yes. The research conducted, as I mentioned, by scientists at Plant Food Research in New Zealand in collaboration with Northumbria University in the United Kingdom, showed that compounds found in the blackberries increase mental performance indicators. For example, accuracy, attention, mood, all that's good, all right? And it impacts a series of enzymes called monoamine oxidases. It reduced the activity, which regulates serotonin and dopamine concentrations in the brain. These chemicals, in turn, are known to affect mood and cognition and are the focus of treatments of both neurodegenerative symptoms like Parkinson's, as well as people just suffering from stress and anxiety. So why not start your day with a little bit of black currants, all right? This was published in the Journal of Functional Foods, a leading journal in the field. So that's one thing. Now, another study that has come up, and this is from the University of Helsinki, which is in Finland, increasing your legumes. There's pulses, legumes, beans, and they're all very good for us. In fact, if you live in a city where you have, and I'm sure all your big cities do, Indian, let's say major, like a health food store, there's a lot of them in New York. It used to be right down by my office. I used to go there all the time. You walk in, and it's just racks and racks and racks of legumes and spices and curries of all types. Well, the legumes or pulses are rich in protein. And one bowl, for example, of lentil soup would give you about 10 grams of quality protein. And you want to have your protein 3 times a day. In the morning, afternoon, and early evening, because the body cannot store protein, so it breaks it down. So people having a high protein diet, they're putting an enormous amount of toxins into the blood with all that excess protein. It is called deaminization, and that is taxing to the liver and your kidneys in particular. So to stay healthy and get your protein, have smaller quantities 3 times a day. And from plant-based is better. So legumes are better than meat and also safer for bone health and protein intake. So this study conducted at the University of Helsinki demonstrated that the substitution, just substitute, processed all your processed meats with peas and fava bean-based food. And they taste great. And there's hundreds of different sauces you can use. Indian cooking and cuisine is just one of the best in the world and one of the most varied. All right, you're getting plenty of amino acids. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. And having the amino acids you need from legumes and beans, nuts and seeds will not adversely affect your bone metabolism, actually strengthens it. All right, so that's one more study of something simple and easy to do. Now, from Vanderbilt University, their epidemiological center, exercise during adolescence is linked to lower risk of death from all sources later in life. So for all of us who are baby boomers, which I am, and many of you are, it was really good that you had a chance to go out in New York City, play stickball and run. And if you were in the suburbs, maybe you were lucky enough to have a ability to run out and run the tracks, bike, all these things we did as kids, unsupervised. And that actually set the stage of slowing down the biological clocks. Now, if you didn't do that, if you were very sedentary as a child, and most weren't, today they are, then the idea is start now. I have a little counter here. I'll show it to you. This is my counter, and I just wear this. You can put it in your pocket or wear it on the outside of your running shorts. And it's a step counter. Now, on a normal day, you're probably going to put in 2,000 steps. If you're very busy, if you work in a hospital, back and forth, the rooms, probably 3,000 steps. But if you start your day biking in high gear, jogging, power walking, and use this, you'll be up to around 6,000 to 7,000 steps. Then in the evening, add another 45 minutes on, you're up to around 11,000 steps. When you go above 10,000 steps a day, you've just added time onto your life. You've slowed down the aging process because it lengthens the telomeres, the end caps of our, particularly our chromosomes. As long as those chromosomes stay tightly bound, and that's what the very important, but not studied as much as we should, is the end caps, the telomeres. And now we have more information that the longer the telomeres in your muscles, the longer those muscles stay vital. So you can continue to not feel weak and waste away. All right, very important. But exercise does it. And the older you get, the more you need that exercise. And by the way, women who are participating in these exercises, adolescents, had a reduced risk of death from cancer and all causes in the middle and older years. That's a big deal. And there were 75,000 women from 40 to 70 in the Vanderbilt epidemiological study. And they did it almost a 13-year follow-up. So exercising is a big part of your health. Now, from the University of Buffalo comes a study that suggests inflammation drives social media use. Now, we know that anything that causes inflammation should be challenged and reduced or eliminated. Fried foods, alcohol in any amount, cigarette smoking, marijuana smoking is worse than cigarette smoking on your lungs. Yes. And then being deficient in vitamin D, zinc, vitamin C, magnesium, selenium, all cause excess inflammation. Being sedentary, being up with cell phones to your face, or think of how many people, just women, put the cell phone down near their bra. That's pulsing right into that tissue, making it very susceptible to breast cancer. So you want to keep the cell phone away from you. There's a cord that you can get, earplug, and it has little blue tubes. And the electromagnetic frequencies are blocked by those blue tubes. You can also get different devices to help lessen electromagnetic fields coming off your computers. That's why, for example, I have a computer here, a monitor here, I have a laptop over there that's, you know, lets me know when someone's calling me from New York or, you know, once on the air. But these are 4 feet away, and I've tested with a magnetometer and other devices. I'm safe. But a lot of people just lean right into them, and kids in particular lean right into those computers. Not good. Anyhow, inflammation is the body's response to injury and infection. But it's also a factor that can lead people to use social media, according to new research from the University of Buffalo communications researchers. They looked at three separate studies of more than 1,800 participants, and the findings were published in the peer-reviewed journal Brain and Behavior. And the immunity indicates that increased levels of C-reactive protein, bad. And by the way, you can bring that down with B1, B6, folic acid, B12, and vitamin C. You can bring it down. Homocysteine, bring it down to safe levels. But if you don't, C-reactive protein, which the liver makes in response to inflammation in the body, can promote social media use among middle-aged adults and college students. So a lot of people live on the internet, and that's not good. So just understand the consequences if you just spend too much time. Maybe you're lonely. Maybe you're bored. Maybe you want to, you know, watch one film after another. And that drives social media use. And that's a growing amount of research showing that experimentally, elevated inflammation promotes social engagement behavior, which in turn then increases inflammation even more, like C-reactive protein. And from that, you can die. Okay? And finally, from Harvard Medical School, once again, another study, the most comprehensive study ever done on nut consumption and colorectal cancer in women, was published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And it showed in this huge study of 75,000 women in the Nurses' Health Study who had no history of cancer, women who consumed 1 ounce serving of nuts, including tree nuts like almonds, Brazil nuts, cashews, hazelnuts, macadamias, cans, pine nuts, pistachios, and walnuts, 2 or more times per week had a 13% lower risk of colorectal cancer compared to those who rarely consume nuts. And the oils that are in nuts, the fats that are in there, are very good for your heart. All right? Now that's not a lot. 1 ounce? You're talking about a tablespoon of nuts. And I'm saying have a tablespoon every single day. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us. All this week, we're going to be exploring in depth individuals, corporations, governmental agencies who are doing their best to censor everyone who is speaking out on an issue involving public health or our political status, anything involving America. They're censoring these people. So we're right back to Orwell, where the truth becomes a lie, and those dispersing the truth through the mediums they do have left, those people are canceled. We're going to show you how this is not unintentional, not when you have hundreds of news reporters using the same identical words on a day that they were told these are your talking points. What happened to integrity in journalism? Well, we're going to be exploring that in depth as well. We have some of the foremost whistleblowers in America coming on this week. We have some of the important dialogue. I started part one for the entire 55 minutes on Friday. Now I'm going to do about 10 to 15 minutes each day this week to continue that. And I posted this on GaryKnoll.com, PRN.live, in our archives, because there are hundreds and hundreds of footnotes. And this project commenced about 7 years ago when I was watching a debate. And both doctors were talking about, you know, do we need all the vaccines? And the argument was, why would you need a hepatitis B vaccine in babies? All you had to do is test the mother, and the mother's blood's tested all the time when they're pregnant. And if the mother's hepatitis negative, the baby's going to be hepatitis negative. I mean, there's no way of getting hepatitis without the mother being the carrier. So why would you do it? And not once did either of these doctors discuss the idea that maybe we had over-accepted the legitimacy of safety and efficacy without actually doing our own independent homework. So that's when I said, I'm going to take this on, and I spent about 3,000 hours of research, writing. Rich Gale spent probably about half that. And then we also had another person that worked with us in the office about 4 years ago, Helen, who did some, and our research editor, Katie. So everyone participated. But what you have now is you have the definitive, scholarly, absolutely accurate discussion laid out showing, yes, vaccines are associated with autism, but why isn't no one in the media, none in the scientific community, none in the medical community, none in the government community accept this? Because they are liars. They're lying to you. You just don't, I don't think you appreciate how you've been played for being a fool. That's what they think of you. Don't believe me? Well, do you remember when the only drug that was allowed when you went to a hospital, aside from intubation, which is, and they explained why, they were overridden. You had to do the respirators and you had to do remdesivir. Do you remember that we were the first radio program in the United States to explain to you that remdesivir had never been tested on SARS? It was promoted by Anthony Fauci. Every hospital had to use it. Later we found out, not at that time, they were given a big bonus, 20% bonus, if they used it. If anyone died, they had to put COVID, they got an additional bonus. All told, you could make $100,000 off a person just by altering the diagnosis and the treatment you gave. And no one questioned it. We did. And we told you that remdesivir had been used in Africa for Ebola, and 54% of the people died within days of taking it from kidney failure. And as a result, the government said you must stop this in Africa. So he stopped it there, then he lied about its safety, and that's why we're guesstimating. We don't have an accurate figure to have autopsies for that, but just look at all the people who would not have died if kidney failure from COVID. We didn't see that at all, but died after they took remdesivir from kidney failure and all organ failure. But don't take my word for it. Listen to Robert Kennedy Jr. Quote, Anthony Fauci knew that remdesivir would kill you. How does it kill you? Kidney failure, heart failure, and all organ collapse. All the doctors said you heard it again and again. We've never seen a virus that attacks the kidneys, because it wasn't the virus, it was the remdesivir. So what do you get today when you go into a hospital? Remdesivir. And guess what they found that they wanted to treat kidney disease with? Remdesivir. You talk about the total, complete corruption of science, it is in place right now. Listen to Robert Kennedy Jr., please.
You want to treat them at home. Give them the things that we know kill viral replication. Zinc and anything that enhances zinc, like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and 100 other remedies that we now know dramatically reduce the spread of this disease. And what was our protocol? Our protocol was to do none of that. No treatment until you go to the hospital. And then your treatment are two things that are bound to kill you: ventilators and remdesivir. And Tony Fauci knew that remdesivir would kill you. He knew that because in 2019, he tried to use it for Ebola. And within 5 days of treatment, it gave lethal side effect to 54% of the people. And the safety monitoring board ordered him to terminate the use of that drug. And he threw a phony, contrived, absolutely fraudulent study that he manipulated and orchestrated, got that drug made standard of care. It is homicide. And if you look, how does it kill people? Two ways, three ways: kidney failure, heart failure, and all organ collapse. And what happened to the people who died in the pandemic? What were they dying of? Kidney failure. All the doctors said, you heard it again and again, we've never seen a virus that attacks the kidneys. Because it wasn't the virus. It was the remdesivir.
All right. The evidence supports what Kennedy is saying. Now, here's something of interest. We're going to go to a clip. This gentleman is Professor of Surgery, John Hopkins University School of Medicine, Dr. Martin McCurry. Now, this is about disinformation. And right now, I don't know if you're aware of this, I want to give you a heads up, but as of immediately, I believe, YouTube is censoring all 100% of any information on alternative therapies. So if I were to tell you right now that if you ate an orange, the nutrients from the orange, including the vitamin C, would help your immune system, that would be considered disinformation, even though there are 1,000 studies supporting that. Everything is being controlled. If you care about your freedom, these are the things that they're showing you, and they don't have fear to do this now, because the people behind the scenes, who you don't know their names, you don't know who they are, they're telling the people at the federal agencies what to do. And like lapdogs, they're doing it. So this is why, walk away from all social media. Walk away. Walk away from Wikipedia. Walk away from Google. Walk away. And you'll find other sources of trust. We're putting everything we have up on YouTube. We're going to put them on Rumble, Odyssey, GaryNall.com, because there, those are platforms that won't be censored. But otherwise, you're going to go to look for something on health, and it'll all be scrubbed. It'll all be gone. And when they take it down, they'll take everything down. That's what they're doing now. So here's a person, a highly respected institution, John Hopkins, and a leading professor of surgery, who's all about, you know, orthodox medicine and supporting the vaccines. But listen to what he has to say. This is under oath he's saying this.
Perpetrator of misinformation during the pandemic has been the United States government. Misinformation that COVID was spread through surface transmission, that vaccinated immunity was far greater than natural immunity, that masks were effective. Now we have the definitive Cochrane review. What do you do with that review? Cochrane is the most authoritative evidence body in all of medicine and has been for decades. Do you just ignore it, not talk about it? That myocarditis was more common after the infection than the vaccine. Not true. It's 4 to 28 times more common after the vaccine. That young people benefit from a booster. Misinformation. Our two top experts on vaccines quit the FDA in protest over this particular issue, pushing boosters in young, healthy people. The data was never there. That's why the CDC never disclosed hospitalization rates among boosted Americans under age 50. We've seen something which is unforgivable, and that is the weaponization of medical research itself. The CDC putting out their own shoddy studies, like their own study on natural immunity, looking at one state for 2 months, when they had data for years on all 50 states. Why did they only report that one sliver of data? Why did they salami slice the giant database? Because it gave them the result they want. The greatest perpetrator of misinformation.
You heard him, the greatest perpetrator of misinformation, U.S. government. So why do people continue to believe in the U.S. government, in anything it says? Just remember this. What if someone told you a lie that adversely affected your life, your health, your survival? They didn't apologize. Would you believe them the next thing they said to do? If you did, then you're an idiot. You're a fool. And karma's going to come real quick for you. But if you say, hold on a second, I trusted you, and you betrayed me, and if you have no trust between people, you have nothing binding them, and the government has nothing that it cares about except maintaining power. Thousands upon thousands of things they've lied to you about, and yet you continue to support them. Your business, but you're not going to like what I see coming, and it's coming right now, just today, on that. But tomorrow we're going to have an interesting discussion of what's happening as far as BRICS. You've heard me mention many times for a long time, BRICS is going to make America eat its lunch. And I mean it's going to hurt. There's going to be pain you have never imagined. You're going to see your 401ks. You're going to see the value of your assets substantially affected by what BRICS is going to be doing over the next 7 years, 6 years. And you're going to say, well, why didn't anyone tell me? Why did my banker tell me? Your banker? Your banker? That's who you're using, an arbiter of ethics? The same people who lied to you about the mortgages in 2006, 2007, and then had to declare bankruptcy, and they were all bailed out, every single one of these people. Not one of them had to sacrifice their job. Yeah, those people. And they've learned no lesson. Neither, it would seem, is the American public. But who then influences all the media? Who influences everyone to start picking up the same message and sharing it? Well, this is a case of Pfizer. Was Pfizer pushing a sponsorship of the vaccine mandates? They shouldn't be. Why? Because, as you can see from an upcoming clip, though I don't see it in front of me, so Dylan, please put the $400 million in royalties went to the government from the vaccine maker. That's a big incentive to keep giving more vaccines. But hold on, you're the agency that says that a vaccine is needed and puts it into a schedule, and then we find out that 90% of all the scientists associated with your panels are all compromised. They've received money. Yet you keep putting more and more and more of these vaccines into the schedule. Yeah. And then you get hundreds of millions of dollars, and individual scientists get millions of dollars. Yes. Well, that's just crazy. Here is Li Fang, F-A-N-G. Li is a highly respected journalist, was. He worked for The Intercept. He'd done a lot of stories. But then he did one story that got him destroyed. He actually apologized. And then I just saw a clip I'm going to play you later, tomorrow, where he says, I should never have apologized. Of course you shouldn't. If you're right, stand up to those who say apologize. No, you don't apologize if you're right. And if they don't like you, so be it. And that's what's happening today with these tiny groups of people who want you to live their way of life, accept everything they say, and abandon everything else that you believed in your whole life. Listen to how he shows in his research that Pfizer was sponsoring vaccine mandates, something it shouldn't be doing, but how clever it was and where they put their money, and then how those people that got their money then began to say, bang the drum, take your vaccines, take your vaccines. This is what happened.
Hello and welcome back to Unheard. I'm Florence Reed. Looking back at the pandemic, critics of government policy will often refer to the corporate interests involved in recommending certain public measures, from lockdowns to masking. We've covered many of them on this channel. Today we're taking a deep dive into the very opaque and controversial question of the motives behind the unprecedented vaccine mandates that became normalized over the COVID era. Li Fang, formerly an investigative reporter at The Intercept, was at the vanguard of some of the biggest scoops of the last decade. He's now the proud owner of, you guessed it, a Substack, where he documents the corruption of public policy by corporate interests, particularly over the COVID era. I collared him downstairs in our lovely cafe and convinced him to come up and talk to me about Big Pharma, one of my pet subjects. Happily, he said yes. He joins me live in the studio now. Welcome to London, Li.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I was really interested in getting you up here into the studio because you've written a big report about Pfizer, which I feel like flew under the radar in many ways and actually is something really significant that, looking back over the COVID years, might tell us a bit more than we think about what interests, corporate interests in particular, were guiding a lot of the public policy during that time. I've got here a list of Pfizer's charitable donations, which is what the report really sinks its teeth into, which we'll get to in a second. But first, I just wanted to ask you about vaccine mandates, as I said there in my introduction. Could you just, for our uninitiated audience, or perhaps our UK or rest of world audience, tell us a little bit about what happened in America across the COVID pandemic when it came to vaccine mandates?
Well, back in 2021, as the vaccines were being rolled out in the United States, there were a number of mandates. Various institutions, major universities, corporations instituted their own internal mandates. Cities like where I'm from in San Francisco had a mandate, New York, various states. And then most controversially, the federal government in the fall of 2021 rolled out their mandate for essentially every employer with over 100 employees. And although each of these mandates differed in some of their particular rules, they generally stated that if you did not receive and take the COVID vaccine, you would be dismissed from your job. There were some, you know, carve-outs for, at least for the federal government mandate. You could be tested, you know, once a week or multiple times a week. These mandates, very controversial at the time, still very controversial. They led to thousands of people being fired and dismissed from their jobs. They did not generally have any exceptions for natural immunity from prior infection. So folks who, especially essential workers who, you know, were on the front lines of this crisis, many of them were the first to be infected, especially in the transportation industry. A lot of those workers were protesting these mandates because they said, look, we have natural immunity. We shouldn't be required to receive this shot to have a job and put food on the table. I was sympathetic to that. I'm vaccinated, but I feel like that was a very reasonable argument at the time. And you look back at these debates, they were very fraught, you know. At least in the U.S. media, and I know around the world, you were kind of branded as anti-science or pro-science, whether you agreed with the mandates or not. They were not up for debate. You were branded as dangerous for society if you criticized these mandates, a dangerous right-winger. You know, this was a controversial policy at the time, and it was sold also by the Biden administration, by Joe Biden himself, from our CDC director, many of the kind of top public health officials, claiming that the mandate was necessary because if you received the vaccine, you would not be infected with COVID. You would not spread COVID. At the time, there was no evidence to show that was the case. There were no studies that showed that the vaccine ended transmission. And we now definitely know that the vaccine did not end transmission. Very decent research showing that for vulnerable populations, the vaccine was very efficient in reducing more severe symptoms. But in terms of transmission risk, the evidence wasn't there. So, you know, these mandates were rolled out throughout the summer and fall of 2021. Very controversial, reshaped tens of, if not hundreds of thousands of lives. And I wrote this story recently for my Substack, just kind of like looking in the rearview mirror and looking at some of the interest groups and pharmaceutical interests that seem to have a role in shaping this controversial policy.
Yeah, of course, there is good profit margins to be made and also public health interests involved here. It's quite complicated. It becomes quite an opaque issue because it's hard to tell the difference often or to separate those two motivations. I suppose here when we're talking specifically about Pfizer, there is a very clear reason why Pfizer might be supportive of vaccine mandates. If you mandate a product, if you're Coca-Cola and you say every child in America must drink one can of Coca-Cola at lunch every day for the rest of their school lives, well, it's quite good for the profits as well. So you can see here the motivations might be quite complex behind it. But of course, as you say there was a kind of moral element which has confused the whole thing about whether or not it was morally virtuous to be vaccinated and whether that was indeed, as Joe Biden suggested, a kind of 100% effective transmission stop. And that, of course, as you say, has come into grave question.
I think the Coca-Cola example is an interesting one. You know, for any major corporation attempting to sell their product, you know, one aspect, of course, is the price, but the other is a kind of a moral argument. What does it mean to you? How does it kind of sync with public policy? How do you, as a consumer, as a patient, as a citizen, interact with this product? And we really haven't seen a parallel to this in modern American history. I mean, this is the Pfizer vaccine, which was partnered with German company BioNTech. This was the most lucrative pharmaceutical product in human history. There is no parallel. And while Pfizer did not publicly comment on the mandate, I think they understood the public relations risk of endorsing a government mandate requiring the administration and purchase of their product. They seem to have a role in shaping this from the outside, from various community organizations, lobbying groups, and healthcare, civil rights, and consumer organizations that did their lobbying on their behalf. And that gets to my story that you referenced at the beginning of your show.
So let's have a look into some of these lobbying groups and influential kind of campaigners who were funded in some way or given grants by Pfizer. Of course, Pfizer has to release this funding information as part of their open policy of reporting, though, of course, it doesn't mean that the people who've received those donations necessarily have to be totally transparent about what they've received, which is something that we'll come onto in a moment. Well,
and that's actually interesting, too, because in Europe, I know the laws are very different than in the U.S., and there's a higher degree of scrutiny in terms of pharmaceutical payments to outside physicians, organizations, and community groups. In the U.S., it's a patchwork of rules and regulations. Pfizer, over 10 years ago, was prosecuted by our Justice Department for engaging in illegal off-label promotion of their drugs, you know, encouraging doctors to prescribe their drugs where there was no kind of regulatory authority. And as part of a settlement from this multi-billion-dollar case, Pfizer was required to engage in additional disclosure. So, you know, they've gotten caught in very similar kind of underhanded lobbying tactics in the past. And because of those settlements they paid for other drugs, we have a higher degree of disclosure for just this company.
Yeah, though the disclosure isn't being looked at by everyone is the thing. It's very easy to bury this in the back end of Pfizer's incredibly complex website, which has lots of rabbit holes that you can go down and you have actually taken a look. So when you do take a look, some of the examples are predictable, I suppose. We've got here the American Lung Association, who received almost $400,000 from Pfizer for a pneumonia awareness campaign. Of course, pneumonia.
What you will hear in the rest of the tape, which you can go to prn.org live, scroll down to archives and scroll on down to my notes, is that they name all these corporate interest groups who got money and nonprofit corporations that got money from Pfizer, and suddenly they started promoting the vaccine. And this was done everywhere. All right? So that's what's going on. Now, I'm going to play a little clip. I'm bringing the person on for an in-depth interview. This is Dr. Heiko Schoening. He's a German physician, highly respected, and he gave a talk, a long talk. You can see it, but he's going to be here, and he'll and wrote about it. He wrote about telling us there was going to be a pandemic, who was behind it, before a single case of COVID was diagnosed or a lab leak was noted. Nothing. Well, how would he have known that? Listen to what he has to say. It's only a minute, 38 seconds.
Thank you for joining Marianne and the professor. I am here with Heiko Schoening, Dr. Heiko Schoening from Germany. Heiko, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Yes, hello.
So Heiko, kind of bring us back to the beginning of when you first dropped into the limelight. You were at a very important gathering in Berlin with Robert Kennedy Jr., is that right?
That's right, yeah. I had the honor to speak in front of more than 1 million people at the great rally we did in Berlin, August 2020. Yes, and most of the people know me because of the event what happened 4 weeks after this. So in London, Speaker's Corner, I spoke out the truth, and then the police came and arrested me at Speaker's Corner. So 700 years of tradition ended at Speaker's Corner, free speech. But the most important is, I said in 2019, months before the corona outbreak, that a fake pandemic will happen in 2020. And I kid you not. And I said this publicly in a long, detailed interview. It was broadcasted September 2019. So I warned the public that criminals are preparing a fake pandemic for 2020. And I named some names, and I named some companies, and this exactly happened. So this is...
All right, here's a respected professor, medical doctor, board certified, published in peer-reviewed literature, and prior to anything happening, anyone knowing about SARS virus outbreak, he named names, a lot of names, many of the names I've never heard of, but then brought them all together. Couldn't he have just been guessing about the virus, about the pandemic, about who was involved, how they did it? You'll find out in our upcoming interview. It's just showing you how many holes there are in their story. Oh, and by the way, for those of you who've asked me, gee whiz, did I see John Bulolin's interview, the most scholarly interview about what he did, and boy, this took time and effort and scholarship. He looked at hundreds of thousands of deaths out of Connecticut, but then he got the death certificates and death reports, and he found that there was a huge spike and deaths from kidney failure. Well, that wasn't the primary cause of death with COVID, because he shows you a separate chart. And here's COVID deaths. And now you have all these kidney deaths. And nobody can explain why. Well, he does. It was remdesivir. How many? He estimates 300,000 Americans were killed by using remdesivir. And this is a guy who's got qualifications up the gazoot. He'll be, I'm bringing him on Wednesday. So you see, we're trying to keep ahead on everything because their walls have been breached. They're in trouble. So they're just flailing away, hoping that they can distract people. All right, they might be able to for a period of time. But when they stop, we're going to be there and we're going to be sharing our information with you. We're going to take a break and come right back, and then I'm going to go to our part two of our discussion. Please stay with us. You never win a battle on the defensive. You have to, at some point, find your voice, find your courage, and go up and put your shoulder with all the others against the tyranny of those in power. I'm sharing this article, the most definitive article that I'm aware of in the world, on the question, do vaccines cause autism? The government says no. Wikipedia says no. Robert Kennedy says yes. Who's right? I want to talk about Cheryl Atkinson, a multi-award-winning investigative journalist who was at the networks for many years. She digs for the truth. Good for her. In the ongoing debate over the link between vaccines and autism, pediatric neurologist Andrew Zimmerman, who is a pro-vaccine figure who publicly defected, the media didn't cover this at all. I understand why. He's allowing the release of a 12-year-old court proceedings in which he testified that vaccines can, in fact, cause autism. I watched the clip I'll be playing on an upcoming program. In the sworn affidavit, Zimmerman told Department of Justice lawyers, and that's, by the way, that's who you have to go up against when you are having vaccine injuries, and they are formidable, and they are absolutely worthless when it comes to looking for the truth. But they work hand in glove with the vaccine industry to defend vaccines against thousands of claims that would he had, quote, discovered exceptions in which vaccinations could cause autism. Let me repeat that. So for Wikipedia, for the invisible editors, for the anonymous people, you said there is no proof. Well, I'm going to give you a landslide of proof. Hundreds and hundreds of articles. And if it seems tedious, I'm going to take a whole hour of tedium to show you the actual references, the date, the page number, the abstract, the peer review journal. And then you have to ask yourself, well, gee whiz, if Gary's presented hundreds of studies in the Library of Medicine showing that vaccines do cause autism, why is it not a single person in the government, not a single person in the media, not a single person in corporate America is willing to acknowledge this? Because they're pathological. They're liars. So here I've got, through Cheryl Atkinson, I give her credit for this, quote, this is the top person defending the government as their expert, Andrew Zimmerman, quote, he discovered exceptions in which vaccinations could cause autism, end quote, citing his own experiences with vaccine damage in autistic patients, as well as, quote, scientific advances. End quote, Zimmerman told the court that, quote, in a subset of children, vaccine-induced fever and immune stimulation can cause regressive brain disease, which features of autism spectrum disorder, end quote. Nobody published or presented a single word on this. His timing couldn't have been more disastrous for the vaccine industrial complex. Not only did it throw a monkey wrench into the case in which he was serving as an expert witness, but many other cases, to be more accurate, 5,000 separate vaccine autism cases were being heard in the autism omnibus proceedings of the vaccine court. I'm going to discuss that later. On June 15, 2007, but as the CDC expert witness, his word carried serious gravity and would have opened Pandora's box of legal actions. So what'd they do? They say, go ahead, just tell the truth. Oh, no, this is the Justice Department, fully weaponized. So it's not surprising that Zimmerman's testimony was covered up for 12 years. It was not even released until 2019. He was promptly fired, and Department of Justice attorney spoke for him in court, describing his position in terms he calls, quote, highly misleading, end quote, by claiming there was zero evidence of a link between vaccines and autism. Robert Kennedy Jr. certainly thought it was more than misleading, calling the substitution, quote, one of the most consequential frauds, arguably in human history, end quote, and filing a fraud complaint with the Department of Justice Inspector General against the attorneys who covered up his explosive admission. But the Department of Justice attorney who lied to the court is no longer with the department, And to look at the CDC's website, Zimmerman may as well not have existed, nor anyone like him, or like the children he had studied. All wiped away. His testimony and work have been memory hold, and the CDC categorically denies any and all allegations that vaccines could influence or contribute to, let alone trigger or cause the development of autism. You're looking at millions of children who have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, and when you add in their parents, and they've all been told it had nothing to do with vaccines. Oh yeah, it did. Had investigative journalist Cheryl Atkinson not surfaced his testimony in her powerful report on, quote, the vaccine debate, published in The Hill in 2019, weaving another scrap of evidence into what has become a very convincing tapestry, perhaps no one would have heard of it at all. Atkinson has doggedly pursued the vaccine autism story for over a decade, speaking to whistleblowers, activists, parents, and others affected by the autism epidemic, and refusing to shy away from the topic despite personal repercussions that would dissuade many lesser reporters. Hacked by the government, smeared on Wikipedia, and demonized in anti-vaxxer buyout blogs, she persists in illuminating the dark corners of power. It is almost a truism at this point to say that the pharmaceutical lobby owns Congress and the CDC and the FDA and the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease and Anthony Fauci. But there are just a small handful of congressional lawmakers and their staffers interviewed on the program agree. Representative Dan Burton, who attempted to investigate vaccines nearly 2000s, and his staffers told Atkinson about the coordinated bullying and intimidation they faced by pharmaceutical lobbyists who, quote, put money everywhere, end quote, to ensure no obstacle stood in their profit path. While former Representative Dr. Dave Weldon confirms, quote, if you as an individual, member of Congress, want to take on the pharmaceutical industry, it's forget it, end quote. The institutional stonewalling has not shaken his faith in the need for an investigation into vaccine safety, and he is certain that, quote, some children can get an autism spectrum disorder from the vaccines. Perhaps weighed down by troubled consciousness, or merely encouraged by the risk rising tide of similar revelations, many formerly pro-vaccine insiders have gone on the record to admit that decades of parental suspicions have been justified. Dr. Bernadine Healy, the former director of the National Institutes of Health, who died in 2011, admitted in 2008 that she thought the government was, quote, too quick, end quote, to dismiss the concerns of the families of vaccine-injured children, quote, without sufficient studies of causation. Healy told Atkinson about a 2004 Institute of Medicine report that, quote, basically said, do not pursue susceptibility groups. Don't look for those patients whose children may have been vulnerable, end quote. Confirming the suspicions of every vaccine choice advocate, Healy admitted, quote, the reason why they didn't want to look for those susceptible groups is because they're afraid is that they will find them, however big or small they are, that they would scare the public away, end quote. As for the link between vaccines and autism, she said, quote, the question has not been answered. Well, that's a whole lot different to say there's no relationship. But let's take a look at one of the more nefarious courts in the United States, the Vaccine Court. A discussion of the special, separate, jury-free, no-fault Vaccine Court will be discussed more in depth later this week. But it's important to mention, in looking at the history of the corruption and cover-up, that the records of the Vaccine Court itself has paid out $4.4 billion since it was launched in 1988 to indemnify vaccine producers against the inevitable lawsuits from parents whose children went to the doctor healthy and came home irreversibly damaged. These speak for themselves. Using the less radioactive term encephalopathy, vaccine court records show some children whose autism onset immediately followed vaccine had pre-existing conditions that would render them susceptible to negative effects, including mitochondrial disorders and tuberous sclerosis. And the connection between vaccines, these conditions, and the autism has been officially referred to as two in multiple cases. When the government settled the historic case of Hannah Poling in 2010, paying out $1.5 million plus yearly payments that would amount to about $20 million over the course of her life, after Poling became autistic following a 9-shot vaccination visit, they qualified their seeming admission of guilt by stating that Poling had an underlying mitochondrial disorder that had her vulnerable to vaccine damage and resulted in her autism. Hers was the first courtroom admission of any vaccine's role in the development of autism and opening the door to the 4,800 autism cases then awaiting deposition in court. Of course, they sealed the case. It leaked out anyway, complete with diagnosis of vaccine-related autism encephalopathy and complete with Zimmerman's opinion. He had, quote, personally witnessed Poling's developmental regression after, quote, vaccine-induced fever and immune stimulation, end quote. They may not have caused her autism, he wouldn't go that far, but they certainly triggered it. Well, then what about doing this? Why not tell all parents, if your child has any of these conditions, it may trigger autism? And when they do a study of any drug, including the COVID vaccines, they excluded everyone who may have had an adverse effect based upon their current conditions. If you had cancer, you're out. Autism, you're out. If you had heart disease, you were out. If you're morbidly obese, out. They had all these conditions that if you had these, you weren't allowed in the study. Well, that's strange, because who are they going to give their vaccines to after the study is finished? The very people they excluded. Think of that for a moment. You can't use this drug, you can't use this vaccine because it may make you sick. 6 months later, you must take this drug. But you told me I couldn't be in the study. Well, that was then, this is now. And nobody ever remembers anything the government says? Okay. So that's unusual. It wasn't the first financial award to the family of an autistic child that admitted some culpability. That was paid out in the first year of the vaccine court's existence in 1986. The court ruled a child's seizures, the result of tuberous sclerosis, were triggered by DPT vaccine, resulting in his mental retardation and autism. They did not admit the vaccine was entirely to blame, but acknowledged that it was a triggering factor in worsening his prognosis, since the age of seizure onset is directly related to the quality of life for individuals with TS. These cases have quietly piled up among the millions, many likely saddled with gag orders that prevent parents who receive some settlement. You can't speak out after that. You even have pharma admitting one damning case of government industry. I'm just looking at the clock. Well, okay, well, I'm going to stop there. Tomorrow I'll pick it up with what the pharmaceutical industry knew and what we've been able to determine from documents in the world to the in the case of the world's largest vaccine manufacturer. That'll be on our next program. But for those of you who've been damaged, and of course, it's always the same. The doctor denies, the pharmacist denies, the nurse denies, everybody denies. Could have been the vaccine. Yeah, it could and has been. But as long as you have manipulated the public into believing you, and as long as you have all the organs of the state acting as your propagandist, the major media, and as long as 98% of all physicians stay together and don't ever find the courage to tell the truth about anything, And as long as you're putting billions of dollars all over the place in the scientific community, well, you've got your influencers. And today, they alone, with the media and the platform, social platforms, are able to blunt, stop, and erase anyone who challenges you. The truth is still there. It's been buried. Finding it is not an easy task, but it still should be done. We're out of time, everyone. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Also, you can go to GaryNoll.com because we're going to, and I suggest this, it's going to be a little effort on your part, but if you value all of the health and nutrition information I share that's up on YouTube, I suggest you go and just download everything you can. Because when they wipe it clean, thousands and thousands and thousands of these are going to be just gone. Now, we have them, but you won't. And therefore, it won't be a repository you can rely upon to help you. So go to Gary Noll YouTube and download all the health information. All right? And you can now go over to Rumble every day because they have not yet been compromised to the point of censorship. And Odyssey as well. All right? I look forward to sharing more tomorrow with you. Have a nice day, everyone.